listening to CPR, communitypublicradio.org. And this is Weekday World. I'm your host, Don DeBar. With a report of some of the news and events of the past 24 hours from the CPR Newsroom. From Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar.
From what I understand, he's somebody who just came into the community, so it is natural for people to not necessarily know him.
That was the voice of a member of the Omar Mosque in Paterson, New Jersey. Reportedly, the mosque attended by the person standing accused of killing at least 8 in New York City, Saifullo Saipov, an immigrant from the former Soviet Republic of Uzbekistan.
If you're coming and you're an outsider, the first place you're going to go to is the mosque. That's going to be your center point. You know, that's where you're going to go, you know, on Friday prayers and say, hey, you know, does anybody need somebody to help for work? You know, if you're looking for work. I know they said he was doing Uber.
But rather than pointing to Uber as a possible hotbed of terrorist activity, much of the U.S. media is now looking at Uzbekistan as demonstrating some connection between Russia's President Putin and terrorism. For its part, earlier this week, Russia was actually helping to end terrorism in the place where it's had the largest body count and caused the most damage in recent memory, Syria. This was Russia's special envoy on Syria, Alexander Lavrentiev, holding a press conference in Astana at the opening of the 7th round of Syrian talks in the capital of Kazakhstan, another former Soviet republic.
Good evening, ladies and gentlemen. I would like to let you know that we've started consultations as part of the 7th international meeting on Syria here in Astana. This is the 7th meeting. A lot of things have happened since over this time. The situation on the ground changed dramatically. Still, we have some issues unresolved that need to be resolved as part of the Astana process, which is what we are currently working on. we've started active consultations between working groups at the experts level, at the high level. We are looking at many different issues, specifically the situation in the escalation zones, the southern zone, the central zone, and the Hamas zone, and of course, most importantly, the Idlib zone, where, as you know, Iranian, Turkish, and Russian observers are present. So we continue coordinating deployment areas for Turkish and Iranian observers. We discuss issues related to stabilization, not just in the Western Idlib, but also in Eastern Idlib. There is a large number of issues that I hope we will be able to work out to stabilize the situation in this rather complex area where a large number of al-Nusra fighters are still present, having a negative effect on the situation in the area. I might say we have a complete understanding with the Syrian delegation. We have had very constructive talks today. I recently was in Damascus, and the Russian delegation met with the Syrian President Bashar al-Assad. In our meetings today, we are also talking about confidence-building measures between the opposing parties. We discuss demining issues, humanitarian issues. We discuss an agreement on exchange of bodies and on the people that are being forcefully held. This is an issue which we haven't been able to resolve for a very long time, but it still takes a lot of time to coordinate all the details, considering all the legal aspects and difficulties. I would like to point out that the 7th international meeting on Syria in Astana is attended also by a U.S. delegation led by the Satterfield Undersecretary of State, the U.N. delegation. We are yet to meet with them today and tomorrow. I hope that these talks will conclude successfully, and I hope that this will lay a strong foundation for the next rounds of the Astana process. It would be premature for me to talk about results or the outcome of these talks. I think we'll review our results tomorrow after the plenary session. If you have any questions, I'm ready to take them.
Question regarding the Congress of Syrian Peoples.
The very name sounds perplexing because it's just the people of Syria. So, what is behind this name? I don't want to get into the specifics of this matter, but I will unveil some of the details. Yes, it is Russia's initiative to have the Congress of the Syrian people, not peoples, plural, of Syria. But after consultations with our colleagues and partners, we decided that the name will be adjusted, and it will be the Congress of National Dialogue. We think it would be more appropriate to talk about the dialogue, because we want to achieve a compromise with the political settlement. As to the location where this Congress might take place, I can't say anything right now. There are several options we're looking at. Some of them were mentioned in the media. It is possible that the Congress may take place at our air base in Khmeimim. We considered this option because of security considerations for all the parties
invited, including the armed opposition, but we're also looking at other options, including places in Russia. Where this will take place specifically, I'm not ready to tell you at this point. This is still under consideration. Stefan de Mistura, as you know, basically supported the idea of having this Congress, of course, with some reservations, but on the whole, he does support this Russian initiative. As you know, the Syrian president has made a very special statement
October 26th.
He welcomed, he confirmed his readiness to launch the constitutional reform. Of course, this process, what he means is preparing a new constitution, and based on a new constitution, there will be a new presidential and parliamentary election, as we hope it will happen under the auspices of the United Nations. Well, we all know very well what happened in Raqqa.
There
was excessive measures used, and after Raqqa was liberated, as we all saw, there were no civilians left in the city after it was liberated. If you compare this to how the Syrian forces liberated Deir al-Zor, it is a totally different picture. In Deir al-Zor, civilians are still in place and they're being helped by the government forces and the Russian forces as well. The situation in East Ghouta on the whole can be described as satisfactory. Humanitarian aid is being delivered. Government forces don't create any obstacles for the United Nations to deliver humanitarian aid to this area. The joint Syrian-Russian UN coordination center works quite effectively. Of course, from time to time, there are certain complications because of provocations by certain groups of Jabhat al-Nusra and even certain detachments of Daesh still in East Ghouta. Of course, we will continue to fight them. So far, we've been unable to mop up those pockets of resistance.
Syria's permanent representative to the United Nations, Bashar al-Ja'afari, is representing his country at the talks. Syria's UN ambassador joined a press conference at the close of the seventh round of the talks, seeking peace in Syria, Tuesday.
Good evening, everyone. Throughout these meetings, we talked about the results of the sixth round of talks and of what was implemented and what was not implemented, speaking about the arrangements made before. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, during the sixth round of talks in Astana, we agreed to create the de-escalation zone in the Idlib province, withdrawing the armed groups to the east of the Abu Dhabi road, at the distance of 3 kilometers to the west of that road, so that everyone would be part of this process, resisting and fighting Jabhat al-Nusra, eliminating this organization designated as a terrorist group by the international community. Also, we agreed that Russia and Iran would send observers to monitor the ceasefire in the region. But what was happening since the sixth round of talks and until this very moment, and the fusion of the Turkish forces in coordination with Jabhat al-Nusra
دون أن تلتزم تركيا بتعهداتها
into the territory of Syria,
بموجب اتفاق خفض
التصعيد بين الدول الضامنة. Does not implement its obligations to maintain the ceasefire agreed
لقد أثرنا هذا الأمر مع الضامنين الروسي والإيراني خلال
we raised this issue
الجولة.
With the guarantors, Russia, Iran.
وأكد لنا الضامنان الروسي والإيراني على ضرورة التزام الضامنين جميعا
and they confirmed that all sides, all guarantors should comply with their obligations.
تعتبر أي تواجد لأي قوات عسكرية
any presence of any military force
دون موافقة الحكومة السورية
without the
بمثابة اعتداء واحتلال وسيتم التعامل معه على هذا الأساس
as occupation which requires adequate response. I would like to read out
نفس البيان باللغة الإنجليزية.
The same text.
During this round of Astana 7, which has just ended, we met with the two guarantors, the Russian and the Iranian. These meetings were, as always, productive and fruitful. We talked about Astana 6. And what was implemented of it. And as you all know, in Astana 6, we had agreed to add Idlib to the zones of de-escalation on the basis of withdrawing all armed groups located in the eastern side of the road of Abu Dhuhr to a distance of 3 kilometers to the west, and for everybody to join combating al-Nusra Front and eliminating it, as it is classified, internationally speaking, as a terrorist group. In addition to that, Iran and Russia should send monitors to observe the ceasefire regime. However, what had happened since Astana 6 till now was that the Turkish forces, with their tanks and armed vehicles, in cooperation and coordination with al-Nusra Front, entered to the Syrian territory in contrary to its commitment, in accordance with the de-escalation agreement signed by the three guarantors. During this round, the current one, we had raised this issue with the two guarantors, Russia and Iran. And from their part, who emphasized the necessity for the guarantors to abide by their commitments. The Syrian Arab Republic considers that any presence of any military forces on its territory without its consent is merely an aggression and an occupation which will be dealt with accordingly. الآن أسئلة وأجوبة.
And now I'm ready to take up your questions.
سرقون هدايا روسيا اليوم. دكتور بشار في الأيام اليومين الأخيرين سمعنا عن مؤتمر الشعوب السوري بعد ذلك عن مؤتمر الحوار الوطني السوري في البداية كان الحديث عن قاعدة حميمين في سوريا بعد ذلك لا يتم استبعاد أي مكان آخر بما في ذلك الأراضي الروسية في حال تمت الدعوة لهذا المؤتمر في مدينة سوتشي الروسية هل ستشاركون؟
In Sochi, we have that forum. Will you be one of the participants?
شكرا. تعرفون أنه منذ بداية الأزمة في بلاد سوريا والحكومة منفتحة على كل المبادرات التي من شأنها
has been open to all initiatives which can put an end to bloodshed in the country, as well as put an end to that unfair and unjust war against the people of Syria. Syria is the first country which initiated the conference on the crisis started in 2012. We've been repeating times and times again that we are for dialogue. We stand up for dialogue. Even when we felt that these initiatives which set forth lead to no results. Despite all that, all that, we've been applying the necessary efforts that very mechanism of dialogue to move forward so that no one could say we are against dialogue, or that we do not want to advance on the political track.
As for the national dialogue forum we've been hearing a lot of these days,
initiated by the
moments
ago, the national dialogue forum is the result of many other dialogues and coordinated efforts which are taking place between us, Russia, Syria and Iran.
فعلى خلفية الوضع الميداني
and our friends in Russia in particular
في سوريا أين
on the front line and taking account
أين في سوريا
the fact that the
أن الفرصة باتت مناسبة أكثر لعقد مثل هذا المؤتمر
decreasing. We think it is the right moment to hold that conference
فيه.
And we are ready to participate.
معك حق بالنسبة للاستفسار عن المكان.
Right.
المكان كان أساسا
to ask about the location where it will be organized.
ثم
we suggested to organize it in Syria.
الاتحادية.
Then decided to move the location to the Russian
بداية
Federation.
بداية الطرح كانت أن سوريا أن الدولة السورية هي التي تطرح هي من تدعو.
First we thought that the Syrian
إلى عقد هذا المؤتمر
state
وهي التي
inviting
ترعى
and organizing this meeting, this forum, that Syria will oversee it. And we never refused it. We never refused to take up that role. But to be realist
and
to correspond our efforts to the situation,
and
the situation is that many groups who receive political and personal help from other
actors,
well-known actors, these groups in Syria, they will not be allowed to participate in the conference in the territory of Syria organized by the government of Syria. After many talks with friendly Russian colleagues, we decided to organize the event in the Russian Federation. First, because Russia is a guarantor. Second, because we can trust Russia as a friendly state, as our ally, which has been helping us to preserve our independence and recapture our territory. The second question. Doctor, we've been hearing about the UN role. First, in the situation with the dialogue and elections or the ultimate resolution of the Syrian issue. So, what is the assessment of the Syrian government, the role of UN? We are the state which is a member of the United Nations. Moreover, so, we are one of the founding
ولذلك نحن نحترم ميثاق
the United Nations and we do respect the charter of the UN.
ونعتقد ان الامم المتحده لها دور
and we believe that the United Nations plays the crucial part
عندما تتمتع بالاستقلاليه المطلوبه.
As the United Nations has the necessary independence despite all the political
فان التوازن بدا يعود للامم المتحده.
The balance is coming back to the United Nations, fortunately, after the great powers started to implement their roles. That's why any role of the United Nations in the resolution of the Syrian crisis is very warmly welcomed by us when we see the neutrality guaranteed by the Charter of the United Nations. The Charter, which reads the sovereignty of the states, should be maintained. That's the kind of neutrality I'm talking about, set forth by the Charter of the United Nations, which focuses attention on the sovereignty of states, of members, and we are a member state. As well as the Charter, reads the respect towards the constitution of Syria, and we also respect the constitution. Thank you.
سلام العبيدي قناة المدعيين. سعادة المندوب الدائم دكتور بشار الجعفري. لدي سؤالان. السؤال الأول كيف كان موقف الوفد الحكومي فيما يتعلق بملف ما يسمى بالمعتقلين؟ أخذ بنظر الاعتبار أن وفد المجموعات المسلحة اتهم إيران أيضا بعرقلة التوصل إلى تفاهمات أو اتفاق في هذا الشأن. السؤال الثاني
hindering the process of negotiations on that matter. The second question has to do with the situation in Syria. You said yourself that Turkey is occupying part of the country. Also, there are American U.S. troops in the territory of Syria. That has also been regarded as occupation by other actors. Was that issue raised during the talks, maybe on the sidelines, especially so that the U.S. side is an observer to these talks? Thank you. First, Syrian delegation, governmental delegation, during the sixth round of talks, presented a document on this very issue. We presented it to the three guarantor countries. And that document reads the official position of our country on that matter. And that is important for us as a state and government, which is the government of Syria. We agreed
بردود فعلهم على ورقتنا بتعليقاتهم بملاحظات على
afterwards the guarantors would bring feedback back to us
وبالتالي الكره في ملعب الاخرين وليس في ملعب
express their opinions on the document but we haven't seen that so the ball is not
بالنسبه للنقطه الثانيه
our part of the field now for some time.
وصدر بيان رسمي
عن وزاره الخارجيه في Idlib province we see the presence as occupation. And as you know, we issued a note which renders this as occupation. During the talks, including the talks with Kazakhstan, we've announced and we declared that we see the presence of Turkish armed forces as an act of occupation. If guarantors to other guarantors would not see that. This way,
and
then Turkey, in the first place, Turkey should be implementing its commitments, its obligations. Otherwise, we'll be responding adequately. We giving that clearly and transparently to others. Everyone should understand that this agreement was reached at the sixth round. It was signed by three parties.
تنتشر قوات مراقبة تركية شرطة وليس جيش.
You see, Saez agreed that Turkish forces could only be policing in concrete regions at specifically defined territories and safety zones. And the other guarantors will be doing the same. So we were surprised and taken aback when the Turkish forces did not introduce these lighter battalions but introduced regular army units, armed vehicles, which is a violation of the arrangements reached during the sixth round. Moreover, in place of confronting al-Nusra and other terrorist groups, Turkey been cooperating with Jabhat al-Nusra in Idlib. This way, these are two major violations on the part of the Turkish forces, violations of the arrangements reached during the sixth round. There are other details, but for us, the most important thing is that we see the Turkish military presence on the territory of Idlib, and that is aggression, that is occupation. We believe that the presence of the U.S. troops is also occupation. In our foreign ministry, we've issued an official declaration, official note, which we transferred to New York. We think that the U.S. presence on the ground and the hostile acts of the so-called international coalition led by the United States is also an act of aggression towards our sovereignty. We've been saying this from the moment when the United States attacked our infrastructure, our institutions. Just as Turkey and Idlib, the U.S. troops were coordinating their actions with the ISIS in Deir ez-Zor, for instance, to give an opportunity to the ISIS to occupy, to seize that mountainous territory and detain 300,000 Syrians. Thank you for your attention.
And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.
Welcome to Worlds Apart. While the Russia collusion saga has so far produced little, if any, evidence linking Donald Trump to the Kremlin, it's been very valuable in revealing the inner workings of the American political lobbyism. Catfishing, phony connections, digging dirt on opponents while crying foul when they do the same to you, and of course, taking money from whoever pays. All of that has been part of the political fiction for years. Is the reality now proving to be even more colorful? Well, to discuss that, I'm now joined by Edward Luttwak, Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Mr. Luttwak, it's great to talk to you. Thank you very much for your time.
Pleasure.
Now, I have to say, I'm a very big fan of yours as a writer on military history, particularly because you pay so much attention to grand strategy and tactical thinking. And when you look at the Russia collusion story from that perspective, the way it was played by both the Republicans and the Democrats, do you think any of the sides gained anything, or at least managed not lose anything from that?
Well, there is a very great desire to delegitimize Trump. There is an attempt to have a kind of American coup d'etat. But the fact that Russia is in the middle of this story is really accidental.
Now, it's interesting you say that, because just the other day, Paul Manafort, Trump's former campaign manager, was indicted on 12 counts, none of which has anything to do directly with Russia. Given how open-ended that Mueller investigation has become by now, do you think Manafort's indictment is a sign that the probe hasn't really found much to support that Russia thesis? Or do you think the investigators are saving the juiciest accusations for later?
Manafort was somebody that Trump had never met. He knew nothing about Manafort. He was offered by the Republican establishment as a campaign manager. Trump had him for a short time and then he fired him. The same Manafort was an active lobbyist taking money from all sorts of people. It is possible, though I don't know the facts, that he may have forgotten to pay tax on the millions he got. The millions he got from the Ukraine, he got it from some Russian-connected Ukrainian. But all of this, it has two parts. One part is that there really is a desire to remove Trump and to do a kind of coup d'etat. And second, Russia gets in the picture because during the campaign, before the campaign, Trump was sending love letters to Russia, to Putin, saying, come on, let's stop this quarreling, let's be friends. And because there was no answer from Russia, he was left as a kind of, as if he's a Russian agent. If Putin had replied by taking action, like withdrawing some artillery from Ukraine, some small step like that, then it would have been statesmanship, statecraft, Trump the deal maker.
Well, Mr. Ludwig, let's leave that on Putin's conscience. I don't know if he has any regrets about it right now or not, but I would still like you to ask you another question about Manafort, because one of the most serious sounding charges against him is conspiracy against the United States. But ironically, it involves not Russia, but Ukraine and former President Yanukovych's efforts to lobby for the EU membership. Technically speaking, that would be much more in America's interest than it is in Russia's interest. Do you think that would be counted as a sort of an extenuating circumstance for him?
Listen, Manafort's name and photograph have been on the front page of American newspapers for days now and always accusing Trump. The fact is that Trump never knew Manafort, never met him until during the campaign, he was hired as the campaign manager for a short period. In a campaign in which Trump hired and fired hundreds of people, including several campaign managers. Now, the FBI, which has been investigating Mr. Manafort since 2006, turns out it's all about taxes. He forgot to pay tax. That's what the big deal is. That's why he can be indicted and all the rest of it. He didn't pay tax on millions of dollars he got. And he got it to work for a Ukrainian leader. Now, this Ukrainian leader was, quote, connected with Russia. So it's all very indirect, and it simply shows that in the attempt to remove Trump, they will do absolutely anything. But Russia would not have been in the picture if there had been a proper response to Trump's public statements, repeated public statements that he wants to improve relations with Russia, and there was no answer from Russia. I mean, notice that Xi Jinping, the Chinese leader, immediately replied to Trump by accepting to put sanctions on North Korea and doing things, and so nobody accuses me of being a Chinese agent.
Well, but Mr. Ludwig, you have to take into account the very long history of mistrust between our countries, so I don't think you can expect from a person like Mr. Putin with his security and intelligence background to just throw himself into the embrace of some presidential candidate in the United States. I mean, this is not the kind of response you would expect from the Russian leadership.
Right. The candidate Trump's love letters don't count. I agree with you. You can't respond to a candidate. But he continued when he became president. He said, let's improve relations with Russia. Let's stop this nonsense of hostility between our two great countries, etc., etc. To which there was no answer at all from Russia. That was a mistake. I mean, I was recently visiting nice parts of Russia, met with Putin's guys. And Putin's people, they all know, of course, that the opportunity was missed. And they realize that. And some other country would have been blamed. There is a necessity to blame Trump for something and to involve him as some kind of foreign agent. This is, of course, ridiculous. It will end. It will fall down. It only makes Trump's supporters more determined to back him. Trump will be reelected. And after he's reelected, probably his daughter Ivanka will become president for 8 years. So all these people know this, and they're in extreme panic, and they're willing to throw anything at anybody, including ruining what's left of American-Russian relations.
Ivanka running for office, I think it's even more, extraordinary than Michelle Obama doing the same.
After Trump, they need a woman president, and Ivanka may well be well positioned. If the American economy continues to grow so well, so fast, and so many jobs are created, and the stock market is so high because of Trump, then all these accusations, all this stuff, you see, most Americans never read the New York Times, never watch CNN, they don't care. They hear these papers filled with attacks against Trump every day. They don't bring the news. They don't tell them the news about their places because they have to accuse them. So there's a whole political atmosphere. However, people who are extremely old, as I am, really ancient, remember Ronald Reagan. When Reagan became president, the senior, most establishment Republican in America, Averell Harriman, the great Harriman, wrote in the New York Times op-ed saying Ronald Reagan would start a nuclear war. And this is the same Reagan who, in fact, was the first American president who said, I will never use nuclear weapons. I don't care what happens. I will never use them. And this didn't stop the attempt to delegitimize Ronald Reagan.
Mr. Ludwig, let me ask you a question about a person who attempted to be that first woman president that you mentioned before. The Mueller investigation has also uncovered that the Podesta Group, founded by Hillary Clinton's campaign chair, Joan Podesta, also received money from the Yanukovych government for similar services without being registered as a foreign agent. The Podesta Group has already been subpoenaed, as far as I know, but do you think indictments are going to follow?
If it took money, did not register as a foreign agent, but paid income tax, then they might not be indicted. Manafort's problem is that he didn't pay tax. You see, in America, ever since the days of Al Capone, even middling criminals know that the way they catch you is by not paying tax. And if Podesta paid tax on this, probably nothing will happen, because nobody actually has ever been prosecuted under this law that obliges you to register as a foreign agent.
Mm-hmm. Now, it's been reported by the Washington Times just the other day that the Clinton campaign and the DNC paid for the procurement of the so-called Trump dossier, which was produced by a foreign national, allegedly relied on the compromising testimonies by foreign nationals, notably Russians. Moreover, the very questionable findings, quote-unquote, of that report, golden showers and what have you, have been leaked to the media in the midst of the presidential campaign. Could that be interpreted as a conspiracy against the United States, or at least an effort to undermine an electoral process?
The true history of that thing is that it started with the Republican enemy of Trump during the primary process, when Trump was competing not with Hillary, but other Republicans.
Yeah, I know, but the Democrats picked up the bill, right?
Correct. What happened is that Trump's opponent in the primary tries to investigate to find dirty stuff about him. Kompromat is the old Russian word, probably forgotten now. Kompromat. Every candidate does it. Every single candidate who has $2 in his pocket will do this in a campaign. And they did it against Trump. The Republicans did. Then the Democrats pick it up. They pick it up, and they do it covertly. But, you know, Hillary Clinton, poor lady, she was capable of losing against anybody. She happened to lose against Trump. She would have lost anyway. And because she lost against really a man like Donald Trump, who is the total opposite, there's been a poisoned atmosphere, because the Trump himself is not a victim at all. Not a victim. He's not poor little Trump. is that Trump is waging cultural war against them. Every day, he's waging cultural war against all their great beliefs. You know, all these wonderful things like transgender people should be able to choose the toilet they use. And anybody can call himself transgender, even he has a beard, he can say he's a woman, or he can have breasts and say he's a man, etc. And Trump has been destroying, demolishing this great cardboard world that they created.
This is not what I'm actually talking about, because if you remember, this initial story of the Russian collusion started with the accusations that the Trump campaign was trying to source, quote-unquote, dirt on Hillary Clinton from Russia. This was the original pretext for the Mueller investigation. Now, the Trump campaign, from what we know, has never managed to do that. Team Clinton not only attempted to do that, but they actually succeeded. They produced this dossier citing anonymous Russian sources leaked to the sympathetic media, paid for by the Clinton campaign. Is that not a proof of them doing what they actually accused the Trump of? And why do you think that does not warrant investigative attention, regardless of what you think about Trump?
Yeah, listen, do you need Sherlock Holmes to prove that Trump wanted Russian help to find dirt on Clinton? You don't need Sherlock Holmes, because Donald Trump publicly said, well, I hoped our Russian friends will give us some information from these emails. So when somebody publicly says something, it's a bit a joke, it's absurd to go and investigate to find out whether he wanted it. He said so in public, in front of all the television sets. You see, what's happening is rather ridiculous. Ridiculous, but serious. And again, the cause of it is actually Trump's cultural attack, which goes on every day. And he is doing real damage. On the one hand, the American economy is doing extremely well, extremely well. Jobs created, growth and prosperity. That makes Trump's enemies, they wake up in the morning angry because of that. Secondly, he's winning the cultural war because of their absurd positions. You know, Americans don't believe that a man with a beard should say he's a woman and use a toilet, okay? So Trump is winning the cultural war. He's winning economically. He's very successful. So at this point, they have to accuse him of absurd things, ridiculous things, that he is a, you know, old NKVD agent, or maybe Cheka agent, recruited by Dzerzhinsky in person. That's one story. The other story is that he wanted Russia to penetrate the emails. Very well. He said so in public. How can you investigate and accuse somebody of doing something which he publicly proclaimed in front of TV cameras?
Well, Mr. Litvaker, we have to take a very short break now, but we will be back in just a few moments. Stay tuned. Welcome back to Worlds Apart with Edward Litvak, Senior Associate at the Center for Strategic and International Studies in Washington. Mr. Litvak, just before the break, we were talking about this Trump dossier, and you were discounting it as essentially, you know, oppositional research. But it's also been reported in the American press that President Obama was briefed on that dossier. It's also been reported that the FBI supposedly agreed to reimburse the Clinton campaign and the DNC for its procurement, that it actually covered some of the travel expenses of that British investigator. If those inner dealings between the Clinton campaign and the executive are proven, how big of a deal that's going to be?
Well, it's going to be a medium-sized deal, because the FBI's involvement in this was actually very proper. There was nothing wrong with it. The FBI was investigating something serious. There is the usual English fabricator, you know, who makes up the documents, and you go and find and look if they have any evidence. But they didn't find any evidence. They found nothing whatsoever. That's why the FBI director testified and said, we have zero evidence against Trump. He said it before the Senate. That continues to be true. But in the meantime, they found Manafort and these people who got a lot of money and forgot to pay tax. And that is how this is going to end. It's going to be end with some people being lobbyists, which is half of Washington a lobbyist, getting money from foreign governments, half of Washington gets money from foreign governments. But if they don't pay income tax, you send them to prison for as much as 30 years.
Well, Mr. Ludwig, not everybody agrees with you. For example, Ari Fleischer, former press secretary to President George W. Bush, well-respected in Republican circles, said the other day that, quote, Hillary and her people have now got caught in the web they created. Do you think the Republicans at this point have any incentive of pursuing that story, for example, to make sure that the chickens come home to roost for the Democrats?
Ari Fleischer is a nice man, but when he says they got caught in the web, of course they were involved in finding compromising material against Trump. No, this is completely unsurprising. It is the discovery that's important, is that her champion, her fighter, Podesta, was in fact lobbying for the Ukrainian government, which the Ukraine must be a very rich country, because they pay millions to almost anybody in Washington to lobby for almost anything. And I am personally sorry that I was too stupid not to get money, millions of dollars from Ukraine for, I don't know, composing a poem about Shevchenko or something of the sort. So what Hillary cannot be in trouble. She lost the election. The election stays lost. She didn't get any money. Therefore, she won't go to prison. So Ari Fleischer says in trouble. But if you mean in trouble, that their beautiful reputation is damaged, that is absurd, because her reputation was terrible. Only the extreme anti-Trump people, like the mayor of New York, you know, the ex-volunteer in Nicaragua for the Sandinistas. I was in Central America fighting the Sandinistas, and it's my great regret that I was never able to get Blasio, even though he's so tall and so big. But the fact is that there's nothing there.
But Mr. Ludwig, you said it yourself. One of the reasons why the Democrats peddled this story so much was because they're still reeling from their loss of presidency. And I think it could be argued that it's not only the frustration processing mechanism, it could also be used to galvanize their base on the eve of next year midterm elections. If the Republicans succeed in turning the tables, don't you think that it may come and hurt the Democrats electorally?
During the election, this coming election, like in every election in America, every single election, what will count will be employment, unemployment. One. Two, for the individual congressman, if a congressman is found with a dead girl or a live boy, that will count. So employment counts, personal behavior counts, and whether you're affiliated or not affiliated with this dead dog, which is the Hillary, you know, Clinton presidential campaign, nobody will care. Nobody will care, just like nobody is going to vote against the Republicans because they think that Trump is a Russian agent or Soviet agent. What will count is that at the elite level in America, there's a war going on. The American elite, which is this extremely aristocratic American elite, is fighting back against Donald Trump, Robespierre, who is destroying their cultural pretensions. I mean, look, in Silicon Valley, these people who have Mexican gardeners, Filipino servants, Czech dog walkers, and Japanese sushi chefs, they're all pro-immigration. The pro-immigration, and they're described as progressives, as leftist progressives, because they're pro-immigration, because they want to have even more foreign servants, and they want to bring in cheap Indian engineers. So the left has become right, the right has become left, and this is what happens when the American Revolution continues. You see, the American Revolution started in 1776, and it continues today.
Well, Mr. Ludwig, you have a very colorful view of the American politics, I have to say. But if I can bring you back to this investigation, because one more individual involved in it is George Papadopoulos, a former foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign.
Excuse me. Somebody who said he was a foreign policy advisor. Do you know how many foreign policy advisors the Trump campaign had? Approximately 7,000. But do you want to know how many people got a picture with Donald Trump? Thousands of them. George, good old George, was different because he managed to go to Europe and got paid for it. He managed to get paid for it. Many other people were running around saying, oh, I'm a Trump foreign policy advisor, and didn't get paid for it.
Well, he not only managed to get to London and got paid for it, but according to the FBI affidavit, he also met there with some professor who was trying to impress him with his Russian connections. And he did that specifically by referring to the Valdai Club gathering as a place where he would meet and supposedly deal with Russian decision makers. I know that you're also a member of the Valdai Club and you attended its gathering in Sochi just last month. Is that the kind of venue where one would lobby for a one-on-one meeting between Putin and Trump?
Right. And I personally, I'm very offended, angry, and upset that nobody offered me millions to set up a meeting between Khrushchev or Brezhnev or somebody of the sort. Why just Putin? I mean, George Papadopoulos was one of the thousands of people, literally thousands, who claimed to be Trump advisors. He went to London and he found a professor who is a member of the Valdai Club. It's not really a club. They just invite you. Perhaps they don't invite you. And then he said, of course, I go to the Valdai Club. He's sitting there with hundreds of people. But he makes it sound like it's in an elevator, him and Putin in an elevator, you know, face to face for hours on end, etc. Nonsense. So anybody who believes this is silly. The fact that somebody paid him shows that they're silly.
Well, that story also includes some young Russian female who supposedly introduced herself as Putin's niece, even though Putin doesn't have siblings, and somebody who also talked about how much the Kremlin would want to have a positive relationship with Trump. It actually looks more like a scam than a conspiracy, don't you think so?
Yeah, it is, of course. But you understand that there is something behind all this comedy, there is something serious. And what's serious is that Donald Trump is waging cultural war against the pretensions, the illusions, the lies, the claims of this American left-wing oriented, progressive oriented upper middle class. The upper middle class in the United States goes leftwards in their positions and rightwards in their reality because they take more and more money. They live surrounded by servants. If you go to Silicon Valley, home of the future, you find that all these Silicon Valley executives, they don't go and do their own, they don't even brush their own teeth. They are living with 30, 40 servants. All of them immigrants. So that's why they're pro-immigration. And somebody who's living with 30 servants is presented as a kind of progressive left-wing person. So in all of this stuff, the Trump Cultural Revolution attacks them every day. So it's not like poor little Trump is under attack. He is, of course, but he is launching the attack to destroy the world of illusion. And there is hatred there, real hatred. The fact that a man, Donald Trump, a man who is this kind of classic man, is president, is outrageous to them. The American president should at least be transgender. You know, if he can't be a woman, he should be at least transgender. It's so outrageous that a guy is a man. So the whole thing is a gigantic attack.
Being a nerd that I am, I also think that what lies at the root of this whole controversy is the lack of expertise, the lack of critical analysis of your adversary. And perhaps the Russians are just as guilty of that as the Americans. Do you have any hope that this whole Russia collusion story, once it's fully investigated and put to rest, may actually prod both sides into changing the way how they study, how they analyze, how they visualize each other?
I hope that it will. I hope it will. But, you know, I read a website called Rusni Vesna, and I find that this sort of poisonous atmosphere really is on both sides. and it is exemplified, and it is now developed. Yes, I think you're right. I think it is now grown to the point, this whole castle of illusions and lies, fears, accusations, that it may fall over. By the way, the last Rusty Vestar story is that the Americans are financing biological stations to find ways of destroying the genes, Russian genetically, finding viruses that will destroy Russians and not Poles, for example. So there is, as I say, it's a castle of absurd accusations. This whole thing will collapse.
Well, Dr. Littrock, let's keep our fingers crossed, but for the time being, we have to leave it there. I really appreciate you being with us today. And to our viewers, please share your comments on our Twitter, Facebook, and YouTube pages. And I hope to see you again, same place, same time, here on Worlds Apart.
You're listening to Weekday World from CPR, Community Public Radio. I'm your host, Don DeBar.